The weather's turned.
But the dig continues.
It's our final week here at Sutton Hoo.
Yes, hello and welcome once again to the Time Team podcast. Martin Williams and Helen Geek in the Time Team Dome at Sutton Hoo. And we're not outside by the trench this time. We've had to retreat indoors because the weather, Helen, is atrocious.
Well, you can't actually hear the raindrops pattering on the roof at the moment, but you can hear the tent flapping because the wind has really got up.
Yeah, the wind has got up, and just every now and again, completely unpredictably, there's just a big downpour.
Absolutely. It sweeps up the river and it descends on our heads.
So we've been battling that all day, and I imagine we will be battling it throughout this podcast. But you're very, very welcome here to the Time Team Dome, which is a little quiet at this exact moment. But normally this is where a lot of people will gather. The members of the public can come in as well, although I expect they are sheltering away from the rain too. You can find out a lot more about the dig that is going on here at Sutton Hoo and just speak to some of the archaeologists who wander in and out to get a cup of tea or whatever that might be. It is our final week here at Sutton Hoo, and we hope you've been enjoying our podcasts from here, and we've been giving you a good idea as to exactly what is going on. A little bit later, we're going to be exploring a completely different part of this site, and that is Riverview Field, which is sort of down the hill from the Hoo that we're sitting on the top of at the moment. And that's because there's some really exciting stuff going on there, which we will get to very, very soon. First, though, can you bring me up to date with what has happened here at Sutton Hoo since our last podcast?
I'm going to start in a rather odd place, which is Trench 2, because actually Trench 2 has been finished. Now, we've done as much excavation as we can, in that we've taken the topsoil down to a horizon where you can see the features, and we have indeed found features, and we've excavated all of those features, all of which have turned out to be natural or just possibly modern. What we don't understand at the moment, Martin, is why they have been visible on the geophysics.
Okay, so that is what is going on in Trench 2. In Trench 1,
it is much harder, actually, to be certain of what's happening. Trench 1 is going ahead incredibly fast, and whatever I say is going to be out of date. But we've got Jackie working on the first cremation that we found, which is the cremation in a ring ditch. The preservation should be good, and it's what me and Jackie are really excited about is to see what kind of evidence of the cremation itself might be in that ring ditch. So everything's changing very quickly because we've got a team of about 8 coarse trowlers out there who are all, I mean, they're all Sutton Hoo veterans. They've all decided to come here for the week to see if they can find one final thing at Sutton Hoo.
It's the power of Sutton Hoo, isn't it? So that is what's happening up here at the top of the Hoo on in Trenches 1 and 2, but we have another site now, don't we?
We've got Trench 3, which is in Riverview Field, and that's where we had the radar that looked very much like the outline of a ship. Now, Martin went down there earlier on to see how that was going on.
I'm making my way through Riverview Field, where there's a huge amount of activity going on. I can see some test pitting going on in the distance. And in front of me, quite a large trench has opened up on the banks of the river with a beautiful view out across to Woodbridge in the distance. And there's John with his digger, and there's Matt directing things. This is an exciting sight.
I'm Matt from Time Team, one of the archaeologists. We have targeted the southwest corner of this feature, which is about 25, 24 metres long. There's a boat-shaped feature and a kind of rectangular feature, which also came up on a different survey. What we're really looking for was these kind of ribs, which went across the boat. We know they're about a metre deep from the radar, but to get to that depth, we've got to open quite a large area, and we need to extend the trench this way, sink down the middle again, and hopefully we'll get whatever these ribs are and prove or disprove whether this feature is a boat. Other options are clay pit, cesspit. We all have bets on in the trench as to what it is.
What are the odds on ship at the
moment? Well, ship, I reckon we're about 10% at the moment. Every time we find a new little feature at the side or something, it's a bit like, doesn't really fit with the ship theory, so it is gradually getting nibbled away, but at the same time it doesn't really fit with anything else. If it was a clay pit, which is another option, there are clay pits in this field, it'd probably be a lot smaller. I would love it to be a giant medieval cesspit, but to be honest, Martin, it's not looking like any of those at the moment.
Hey, John, how you doing?
Hello, Martin. Fancy seeing you here.
Fancy seeing you here. How's it going then?
Oh, it's amazing. This is like one of the sites everybody would like to dig on, and I love it.
Hello, I'm Giselle. I'm one of the archaeologists on site.
Conditions today, well, a little bit wet.
They're very wet. Yeah, we didn't have much rain overnight, but we are down by the river, so we've got a bit of a water table issue at the same time as rain this morning. So we've got some sticky clay, we've got some very wet sand, and all of it gives us little platform boots because it gets stuck to the bottom of our boots.
Matt's told me about the bet as to what's in it. So where's your money?
So I'm still hoping for a boat.
We're all hoping for a boat. I know,
but how great would it be if it actually is one? I'm kind of on the whole dock idea. I think a dock would be amazing. We've got clay on one end of it, the kind of end that's towards the water. If there was a boat here, it would have to come in on a high tide, get stuck in this spot with that clay as sort of a boundary that stops the boat from going back out as the tide gets lower. The idea is there. The geophysics kind of looks like one. Who knows what it is, but it is fun having a little bet going on. That is nice.
That is such a weird sight down in Riverview Field. It looks like nothing I've ever seen before. And Riverview Field's an unknown quantity. You know, we don't know what might be there. We're working from first principles. And to see some actual archaeology emerging from when all we've seen is the radar, it's very exciting, very tantalising. And with all the 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 theories of what it might be, every bucket scrape seems to give us something different. So it's going to be very interesting to see what the final answer is.
Absolutely. Now, there's a lot of test pitting going on as well in Riverview Field, and you'll hear a lot more from there a little bit later on in the podcast. But right now, I want to talk about a thing that happens here, a process that happens here at Sutton Hoo during this time team dig. And I'm doing it, by the way, as the rain is really starting to come down now. It is getting a little bit worse. But what will happen very often on a site is that somebody will be getting very excited about a find that they've come across. I don't know, it could be a coin, a bit of metal, maybe a bit of pottery, and they'll go, oh, I've got something here. And those finds eventually make their way to Tranmer House. And when they get to Tranmer House, they come across somebody like Jenny Glazebrook, who is here. Now, Jenny is the supervisor of the finds team and was here in the 1980s as well. Lovely to see you. Welcome to the Dome.
Thank you. Hello.
Hello. So you were here in the 1980s,
yes,
along with Helen,
yes,
as part of that dig. And now you are supervising the finds team, which involves what? A lot of paperwork, I imagine.
A lot of paperwork, quite a bit of washing up, mm-hmm, and some marking and a fair bit of bagging. Bagging and stuffing.
I don't know whether we can really carry on with this unbelievably loud raindrops that aren't falling on our head, luckily, but they're whizzing past the door of the Dome. One person has just run into shelter, and I imagine there may be some more soon. But Martin, come on, what's the technical stuff about the radio? Can people still hear us?
Yes,
despite,
yes,
this absolute din? We can hardly hear ourselves.
Now, you've brought with you some of the finds that have come in to Tranmer House over the course of the last few weeks. What have you got? Should we start with this first one? You've got three of them,
yes,
here. This is a bit of flint, this is here?
Well, this is very recently found, mm-hmm, but we've had few flint tools that are this lovely. It's,
yeah,
a very finely worked piece of flint, which is thin and translucent, has been retouched, and it's a knife. It's a flint knife.
Oh, right. So one of these edges would have been Very sharp.
Yeah. Well,
can I hold it?
If you hold it, you'll see that it does fit the hand.
Oh, yeah.
So would this have had a handle, Jenny, as you understand it? Or could it have been held just in the hand?
Some of them, I'm sure, were just held in the hand.
And because they're quite ephemeral tools, aren't they? They're quick to make. Yeah. If you find the right piece of flint and, and if you damage it, which you can quite easily, then you just chuck it away and make another one.
Or sometimes if I imagine if they blunted, you could retouch and sharpen them up.
It doesn't make it any sharper, but it makes it more
robust.
Yes.
The tools change slightly over the years.
Oh, here comes the wind.
The wind as well. Gosh.
It's all right.
I almost blew the vines away.
They change slightly over prehistory. I've heard that Neolithic flints can be much more finely worked.
Yes.
And that because they didn't have metal, so the flint had to do everything. Everything sharp, everything cutty, arrowheads, weapons,
so
everything.
So the far more of the flint tools were made by what you might think of as a professional. There's nobody... Oh, that's Kerry hammering in the tent pegs so that the wind doesn't blow the door open again.
This could be a long job.
I hope you're getting the idea of the professionalism of this dome.
Yeah. Shall we talk about the second find here? Because this looks a lot more modern. The ceramics with a little bit of blue colouring in there.
Well, it is blue and white ware, funnily enough. Mm-hmm. Probably 19th century, maybe. Yeah, I'd think 19th, maybe early 20th.
Was that from one of the test pits down in Riverview Fields?
That is from a test pit, yes.
Yeah.
This is newer, slightly less exciting, but still gives us an idea of some of the things that would have been going on in that area. It paints a picture of life through the ages.
There is that, but more important archaeologically, it means that whatever layer three is, it's got modern stuff in it.
Right, so you're able to date where you are.
By the most recent thing in the layer, especially if it's too large to have been taken in by a worm.
Yes, and that's
pretty
big.
It's the dating evidence. It's all important.
And finally, what do we have here?
Well, finally, I chose something that also came in this week, which is a bit of one of the Anglo-Saxon urns. And this bit has got some stamps. It's decorated with stamps.
Oh,
so it's probably up near the rim or the shoulder.
On the other side, there's kind of voids on the...
Yes.
Yes. Show Martin those voids. And might those be where some kind of organic filler in the clay has burnt out? Because that's quite a diagnostic thing.
Yes. And sometimes they put organic matter in the fabric chaff or grass. Other urns, this has got sand in it as well, but it's quite a smooth, soft fabric.
I'm going to have a little feel of it.
You're actually holding a piece of Anglo-Saxon cremation urn there, Martin. That's not something that most people get to do.
Does it give you quite
a kind of frisson that you're only one step away from somebody gathering up burnt bones and popping them into an urn?
Well, that's it. You aren't you? You do feel quite close to the person that would have last handled this before it was
buried. Yeah.
Buried.
Yeah. For all those centuries.
I'm going to very quickly pass it back to you because I don't trust myself.
Yes. Now, one of the things that we haven't really got our heads around is the immense amount of listing and work that goes on in the finds room, because the flint, you pop it into an inventory, don't you, Jenny? So if I come in and I say, show me the piece of metal from cremation 2, within a few seconds of flicking in a book, you've got a number, you can find it in a box and
out
it pops.
Fast. Absolutely, within seconds, we aim to please, or possibly by tea break the next day.
Jenny, thank you so much for coming and showing us some of those amazing finds, which are among, well, how many do you think there are there now?
This year, we've gone from 793, we're already into the high 1200s.
Wow.
So that's 400 to 500 from the site. That's not the test pits.
Okay.
Haven't counted those.
Really? Gosh, we have got a long way to go then.
Certainly sounds like it. Jenny, thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is the Time Team podcast, and thank you very much for listening, by the way. Lots of people have been coming up to us and saying that they're enjoying the podcast, which is good to hear.
It's lovely when somebody actually says, I've been listening to the podcast and I think it's great, that they've actually bothered to come up and say that. It's really nice.
Yeah, thank you so much. And it's been great to meet as well a lot of Patreon members. And if you do support us on Patreon, you get so much more from Time Team. You get some behind the scenes stuff. So the other day, Helen and I recorded this little video where we went round the whole site, didn't we, on an electric gator. It was really good fun.
You were driving.
I was. You were holding on for dear life. I saw your facial expression. Don't you worry about that. That was really good fun. But it also gave you a lot more information about the site, putting it in a bit more context. That is there exclusively for Patreon supporters. You also get the opportunity to ask a question as well, and more of your questions from Patreon coming your way a little bit later on in this podcast. Head to patreon.com/timeteamofficial for more information. Now, I mentioned back to Riverview Field a few times in this podcast. I'm going to be heading there in a little bit to find out about some of the test pitting that is going on. But first, Helen has been down on the foreshore, actually, of the river to see what's eroding out of the cliff.
I'm just on the bank of the River Deben, and although we call it a river, it's almost really an estuary here. We're on the other side of the river from Woodbridge, and if I look to my left, I can see Woodbridge's tide mill, and just next to that is the long shed where the Sutton Hoo ship replica is being built. The river is at low tide at the moment. The weather is absolutely terrible. It's windy, it's rainy, but it is really nice to be down here in the fresh air with the green of the seaweed and the brown of the mud. It's all just looking lovely. There's various volunteers spread out in front of us, all in thick anoraks and filthy boots, kind of playing in the mud. They've got trowels. They're moving in a systematic way with their trowels up the foreshore, looking for flints, for pottery, for metalwork, for anything they can see that has been made by a human. And at one end, I can see Karenza Lewis from Time Team, who is running the whole operation for the National Trust, who really want to know more about their riverbank. So let's go and join her.
This is the one area, this slightly higher bit of land, is the one area where you can get out to the edge of the river dry shod. So this is the sort of place you'd expect people who are using the river but living up there to be coming to and fro in. So what we wanted to do was to do a bit of foreshore survey. As you can see, you've got the edge of the spur, as it were, is eroding away very actively here. So we wanted to sort of do effectively field walking to see what finds we might have.
I'm Poppy, I'm one of the volunteers that supports Time Team on Patreon, and I'm here mudlarking today. I mean, it's very wet today, which is great, but it's been quite an interesting experience to come down here and mudlark. It's kind of wandering with your trowel, looking at the surface, looking at the layers in the cliff edges, I guess you could say, or the edges of the side of the river, and just having a look through to see what there is, see if there's anything of interest, and then proceeding from there.
So have you found anything exciting yet?
I found a couple of pieces of worked flint, and we've bagged those up and popped them in the side for someone to look at later on. I think one of the other girls found probably some metal, maybe from, I don't know, old ship item. It's really interesting to see like the layers in the cliff edge, I guess you'll call it, and also how our finds down here compare to our finds in our test pit, because they are a little bit different but also kind of similar, so it's given us some idea of what the variation is in the areas.
We're getting masses of prehistoric stuff. We're getting lots and lots of bits of worked flint.
Should we literally, John has just
found this.
Yeah, again, doesn't look like it's travelled very far.
We're finding quite a lot of these. So this is looking like this sort of early Neolithic stuff.
You can see it's really fine.
I think that's actually quite good quality flint, isn't it?
It's
you can kind of see
flint
through it.
So that suggests that we've got Neolithic activity really close to here. There's a lot of arc. You can see we've got a whole load of... everywhere there's a flag. Oh. Each of these pink flags is where we've got some finds. They're nearly all worked flint.
And so do I gather that it's very high quality, the worked flint down here? That bit you showed us
Some of it is like the bits I've just shown you. Mm. There are other bits that are quite roughly just broken up.
Do you think that these are actual kind of like working places, intact kind of flint working floors?
Yeah, I do think...
That makes it quite important.
Yes. I think we've got some intact surfaces. And what we'd quite like to do, if we could just get the weather to do us a little bit of a favour, is sort of cut this back a little bit and get a vertical section. If it was nicer weather, it would be a lot easier, A, to do everything. And we're very tied to the tide, so I'm going to have to go and get the surveying done, and we've laid out the tape measures there. We're going to lose them under the tide coming in.
Because this is low tide now, isn't it? Or in half an hour or so.
Yep.
How far up does it come?
Right up to here.
Yeah, so it's typical intertidal archaeology, isn't it? You've got to work very fast.
Absolutely, yes.
looking at this minute in time, I'm like, I'd do anything to dig. This is absolutely fine, whether it's raining, snowing. It won't snow, but you never know. But yeah, it's been great, so really enjoyed it.
Lovely. I'm really glad you're enjoying it, yeah, because you're doing great work.
Yeah, it's been really a really nice experience, and everyone's having a lovely time. We've made a lot of friends while we've been here, so even though it's wet, it's been great.
Goodness me, Helen, that sounded damp.
Yes, it was damp underfoot as well as dampness coming down from the skies.
The weather then is kind of in and out, isn't it, today? There's moments where it isn't raining and there's moments where it's absolutely tipping it down, which I imagine, yes, makes doing archaeology quite difficult, but also remember, we're trying to make an episode of Time Team. We're trying to make some television here, and Emily, our director, has we've managed to grab her just for a few moments.
Reluctantly.
A little bit reluctantly. How is it going in this weather?
If you'd seen George, who's doing the second unit on this one this morning, trying to fasten an umbrella onto his backpack to give himself some cover so that he wasn't going to ruin the camera while he was going down to film down near the river, you would know.
So it was a huge umbrella. It looked like the sail of a yacht. It did. Ready to fling him into the river.
It did. He was being strapped in with gaffer tape by one of the Operation Nightingale military volunteers that we have here. But it doesn't seem to have worked, sadly.
Everyone is just going to get wet. Yeah. Aside from battling the weather, you're battling across several sites, aren't you? Because you've got to spread yourself and indeed the people that are around with the cameras and trying to capture the moments where we make a discovery, where something happens of interest across quite a few different locations. How are you managing to do that? Because we're up here by the dome in trenches 1 and 2. We're down at Riverview. There's other things happening at various other parts of the site. How are you managing that?
Well, it is tricky, but then it's always tricky on a time team. That is the job, that you have multiple units in different places and you're trying to gather all the different storylines, but also you're trying to second guess the storylines. So you're trying to totally revise the thing that you thought that you were going to film and imagine what you might be going to film and the story that might be emerging, and then get the pieces in the right place to tell that story. So it's always a massive juggling act.
And you're telling several stories at once, aren't you? You're not just telling the story of what happened here from the Mesolithic to the Second World War kind of thing, concentrating on bits like the early Anglo-Saxon period that we happen to think is the most exciting. But you're also telling the story of how we came to know about it, how we are digging it, the ups and downs. You know, first week everything seemed to be going brilliantly and it just seemed that we only had to stick a spade in the ground to find a cremation and then it all tails off and we think, oh heavens, what is this huge acreage of nothing in the middle of the trench?
And then slight panic sets in when you think, I hope that it's not actually nothingness. Yes. And we are actually going to find a story and that it isn't going to peter out entirely. But I mean, you know, we're in Sutton Hoo. There are so many stories and there's been so much work here and there's so much history and there's so many absolutely fascinating tales that can be told. And really, part of the thing that I'm trying to do here anyway is to find something that allows us to tell some of those stories. And it's not just about the story of the history of the site, but it's also the story of the archaeology on the site as well, which Helen's been involved with Martin Carver's been involved with. And it's just fascinating. So actually, whatever we do, even if we find nothing, there are brilliant stories to tell. It's just a question of like having a massive deck of cards and it's like, pick a card, any card. Oh, that's the wrong card. Could you put that card back in?
Well,
it's a bit like that.
We won't keep you any longer because I know how busy you are and being pulled from pillar to post. So thank you.
I've got to put the camera back in the finds bag so that I can go out back into the rain again.
Yes,
at least we have lots of plastic bags on an archaeological site.
Exactly.
Well, good luck. We're staying here in the dry.
Very wise.
This is the Time Team podcast coming to you from the Dome in Gardenfield at Sutton Hoo, just metres away from our two trenches, Trench 1 and Trench 2, where digging is carrying on despite the weather. Shortly, we're going to have your Patreon questions. But before that, Martin's been down to our other site in Riverview Field, where he's been looking at the test pits.
Hello, I'm Lee, and I'm here on Test Pit 8. We're about 40 centimetres down of hopefully about 1.2 metres. There's a bit of a change going on in our layers at the moment, where it's getting a bit more compact and a bit more clay-like. It's been very, very dusty and quite sandy with some kind of shell flecks in it, but we're coming down into something else now, so which is quite nice.
And what are you hoping to come across here?
Down this part of the hill, they think it's going to be something to do with maybe boat building, or certainly something along that lines, because we're close to the river here. So we're not too sure what we'll find. We found some little bits of pottery and glass and some ceramic building material. That's what we've got so far.
My name's Alison, and I'm digging test pit number 8.
You've got the hard work here. You've been put right in this pit, digging away.
Yeah, but I'm still having fun.
Good, well, that's the main thing. What's it like doing this? How hard work is it?
It's extremely hard work, because the ground's very tough at this level. It's really dry and hard.
Being here around the other volunteers, seems to be a lot of camaraderie. What's it like volunteering at Sutton Hoo?
It's fantastic. We're all getting on really well, because we're all interested in archaeology and we're all fans of the Time Team. So yeah, we're having a good time.
Some hard work going on here, a lot of sieving. Hello, who do we have here? What are your names?
I'm Christina.
I'm Ruth.
And explain what you're trying to do here as you sieve this soil.
Well, we've got a sort of a platter-like sieve that has quarter-inch holes, and we're sieving through all the soil that's coming up through the pit, trying to locate any finds.
It's very tough going, because there's a lot of hard, small lumps, so we're having to break these up to actually see what's inside of them. Quite tough going.
Have you come across anything of interest yet?
A few little bits of pot, something glazed as well, which was quite nice. Possibly something pottery that was Anglo-Saxon, a lot of charcoal, lots of bits of flint.
And what do you do when you get something that could be of interest? What do you do with it?
We've got a plastic tray called a finds tray.
Oh, this is your finds tray here. Yeah. So these are all the little bits of pottery and the flint. Oh, I can see the flint that you were talking about there. Right, so there's a few bits there. I don't really know what it means, but I'm sure somebody would be able to look at that and tell you that that means something.
Yeah, that's what we're hoping. We put in everything we think is something that is worked that could have been touched by humans, and then at the end of the day, Karenza or Danny will go through and sift out the things that are really rubbish, and then keep a bag up everything they want to go look at in the finds tent.
I did my degree in 2006 in archaeology, but was inspired at the time by Time Team. So to kind of come here 20 years later to be able to get the chance to come and dig, just for Time Team in general, but also being at Sutton Hoo it's really, really special and really exciting, and I'm really, you know, grateful for the chance through kind of Patreon to be able to do that and to join in.
Well, we're delighted that you're here.
Thanks.
So keep up the good work.
Thanks very much.
It's really interesting to hear from the test pits, because test pits they can be quite a controversial way of archaeological evaluation. But I think in Riverview Field, they're quite necessary, because this is a new field in the Sutton Hoo Estate. We don't know very much about it. We don't even really know about the soils that we're expecting underneath. So these consistent, comparable 1 by 1 meter test pits are a really good way of checking how deep our deposits are, whether there's any archaeology there, just giving us a baseline about what's going on in that field. The most useful thing, though, is that we can see those soils, and that all helps us predict what the archaeology should be like. And bearing in mind that it's between the Hoo and the river, and we know that those are two really interesting resources, those test pits are going to be fascinating.
And the volunteers that are manning them as well are doing a brilliant job. It was so lovely to meet them, and they all get to be friends because they're all working together in the same little pit, so they all get to be friends as well, which is very nice. Shall we move on to some questions to finish this episode of the Time Team podcast?
Why not?
Lots of people have been getting in touch on Patreon. That is the way to do it if you want to get your question to Helen. Now, earlier on, there was a video that went up on Patreon, and it was you and your husband, Angus, who is a very important person here at the National Trust, sort of bickering, weren't you?
We do little else.
but you were talking about your contrasting theories on where King Redwald might be buried. Lots of theories. people want to know what your one is.
Well, actually, most people do believe that Redwald is buried in Mound 1. He was the most famous East Anglian king, the most powerful, the most innovative, the most interesting, and he died in 624, 625 AD, which is just perfect for Mound 1. So we've got an extraordinary burial, we've got an extraordinary king. They match, don't they? Well, they appear to, yes. But then don't forget, we've got Mound 2. So we've got another ship. What we know about Mound 2 is that it was just as extraordinary as Mound 1. So, okay, we don't have one exceptional king and one exceptional burial. We've got two exceptional burials. So what's to stop Redwald having been buried in Mound 2? The only thing that stops Redwald being buried in Mound 2 is we don't like to think that we haven't got the grave of Redwald. So that's why we always put him in Mound 1. The two are absolutely contemporary. What I would like to do is shelve Redwald and say, well, we've got two extraordinary burials. Where do we go with that? Where do we find a moment when two kings die at the same time? And the answer there is that we have a battle in which two East Anglian kings die. This is Sigebert and Edgeric in 636. And I think a lot of archaeologists would say to me, that is 10 years too late. And at that point, I would say, can we really see a burial that's 10 years later than another burial? Today, could you work out a house that was built 10 years later than another house? No. It would be really difficult. We don't know that Redwald was buried in Mound 1. But then I have to say, look, I know it's all really special pleading because I excavated Mound 7. That's my favourite burial mound, obviously.
You want him to be in there.
Yeah, now, but there's a logic. So the dynasty that's almost certainly 99% likely to be buried at Sutton Hoo is the Wuffings. And Mound 5 is the earliest mound. Now, what about if Wuffa is buried in Mound 5? What king have we got next between him and Redwald? Well, we've got King Tytla. And he could be buried in Mound 6, which is probably the second mound. Mound 7 is probably the third mound. And the next king after Tytla is Redwald. Logically, I feel Redwald is probably buried in Mound 7.
You've made a very good case for it, actually.
But many people would say that 624 or 625 is too late for a cremation in a bronze bowl. So the debate continues.
Let's do a couple of kind of quick fire ones that have come in from people on our podcast chat, which you can find on Patreon. Anne Radmore says, from seeds, etc., is it possible to tell what plants and flowers might have been blooming when one of the mounds was completed so we can imagine it in full colour?
Well, that is a very interesting question. And I think what it boils down to is what was under the mound. What was going on when the mound was started rather than when the mound was completed? When the mound is completed, it's got the very highest topsoil, which in this environment of sandy soils and strong winds and so on, can blow away and other things can blow back. I don't think we can think about the very top of the mound. What we can think about is what the rest of the countryside looked like, what the immediate area looked like when the mound began, because that is buried under the mound makeup. So the holy grail of digging a mound is to find the surface upon which it was put. Now, what you would really like to see is something like a turf line. And then you might be able to discover maybe, if you were really lucky with a slightly anaerobic environment or something. But obviously seeds don't survive well. I mean, this is really a question for Naomi. But if you want to ask me as a non-expert, I'd say it's all in the buried soil. The thing about the buried soils that we looked at under the mounds, though, is that Mound 2, you couldn't see a turf layer. It appeared to be a plough soil, but you couldn't really see a turf layer on top of that. So we were never quite sure whether turf had been stripped or whether it was put onto a ploughed surface. Mound 6, we also took the mound off to look underneath. At that point, again, it was not terribly clear. We had various theories about how do you lay a mound out, for instance? How do you make that perfect circle? And we had an idea that maybe you could plough in a circle to mark it out, or maybe you could lift the turf to give an idea to the builders as to where to stop. How you build a mound is still a bit uncertain, because when we unpicked Mound 2 very delicately all those years ago, what we really found was that it had just been higgledy-piggledy pushed together. And also,
it's one way of doing it, though, isn't it?
Yes, I guess. It's the quickest way.
Yeah.
And also, it had a lot of rabbit burrowing, so there's quite a lot of disturbance.
Great question, Anne. Thank you very much. I think we've gone on a journey with it, and I like where we ended up. One final one, then. This comes from Joachim Willemsen, who says, long-time fan here with a question which has been nagging me for days. Are we certain the ship was dragged up the slope? This is the ship, or one of the ships.
Well done, Martin.
I'm learning. Mound one and mound two. Or is it possible it was disassembled along the river and put together again in its final resting place? The latter seems less laborious. Can I just say, Joachim, before we hear a proper answer, I have been to the ship reconstruction project in Woodbridge, and I have seen them hammering the rivets into the side of those ships. And what you're doing, you are bending the metal and it cannot be unbent again. So getting the rivets out to then disassemble the ship, to me, you would just destroy the ship. You wouldn't be able to put it back together again. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. I would have thought that dragging it up a hill would be easier than disassembling it.
I agree with you, Martin. I think you're right. Joachim, I don't know if you've been down to the ship reconstruction project, but the amount of effort that's needed, the amount of muscle that's needed to put all that together, I think the easier option is to pull it up a hill. But the thing is, though, we don't know which hill. It's a toss-up between short and steep or long and gentle. And Stuart has been modelling all sorts of how many people we might need to pull it up this kind of gradient and for how long and so on and so forth. And he, I think, I'm hoping he's going to come up with an answer of what he believes is the right route. But that's just going to be a hypothesis. And what I'm really looking forward to, because we so rarely get the chance to actually test one of Stuart's hypotheses. You know, he says these things which are untestable. And we all think, well, that's all very well you said that, and it's all very likely, but we've never managed to test it. This time I think we're going to be able to test it, because with the Sutton Hoo reconstruction, the ship is going to be first rowed, and then it's going to be sailed, and then finally, towards the end of its life, we're going to try to drag it. Now, you may say that if it's towards the end of the ship's life, if we try to drag it and it falls to bits, that's awkward, isn't it? We're going to have to build another one and try and drag it up a bit earlier in its life, because if it can't withstand the pulling, that is going to be a slight problem. But there's no substitute for actually attempting to do it. We know that the ship was damaged and mended.
Do we know that was as a result of dragging?
Or well, we think it probably wasn't as a result. Because of the specific damage. I think if it's damaged and repaired, you would only want to repair it if it still needed to be watertight. If you damage it in the dragging up, then as long as it's not too visible, it still serves its purpose as a burial container. So everybody's got their opinion, but eventually it will be tested.
The proof of the pudding is in the dragging it up a slope. Brilliant. Great questions there, Joachim. Anne, thank you very much. If you want to add your question, we have an ongoing community chat on Patreon, which you can join in with. And lots of people kind of chime in, and it's a big old fun community that you can join in. And you can ask a question there as part of it, which we can include on a future edition. This is our final episode from on site at Sutton Hoo. We're going to be probably talking about it, I imagine, next week. There is an awful lot to discuss. Thank you to Sutton Hoo for having us, because
absolutely,
it's been
brilliant.
We've had such a good time. I've learned loads. I've experienced loads. Hopefully we've been able to bring some of that to you, some of that learning, some of the experiences.
And we've had so many visitors.
We've
had over 1,000 visitors some days, which has been really lovely to meet some of you and to hear what you enjoy about Time Team and about the podcast. It's been a real delight.
It really has. Well, we will speak to you again on another Time Team podcast. Until next time, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.